Welcome to When Your Kids Push Your Buttons, Part 2. This is Bonnie Harris, and I'm thrilled to have you back to do the deeper work of Part 2. I am very happy to say that I've had wonderful feedback on Part 1, and practically everyone from Part 1 is continuing on. In Part 1, we focused on the messages our reactions send to our children across the gap. Now, in Part 2, we're going to look at the other side of the gap and the messages we received as children from our parents when their buttons got pushed. First, I want to do just a little short recap of Part 1. We learned how easy it is for us to send completely unintentional messages to our children, that they are problems, pains in the neck, unimportant, unacceptable, not good enough, disappointments, etc., etc. And in doing so, we create a gap where connection is lost. Our best intentions drop into that gap when our buttons get pushed. And to change things, we need to diffuse those buttons and stop taking our children's behavior so personally when we react from our fears and our judgments, those wonderful assumptions that we make that seem so true and accurate in the moment. In order to do that, we looked at what we have to do to reframe those assumptions, to change our thoughts from judgments to observations, so we can get from anger to compassion. One of the ways is to make sure we see that the behavior we hate means that our child is having a problem, not being a problem. For instance, when I assume that he never listens, he's so demanding, I always have to do things his way, that makes me feel out of control, and I react in an attempt to get back in control, which never works. But if I can think instead, I bet he's not listening because he thinks he's going to get in trouble or have to do something he doesn't want, then I'm in a more understanding, less reactive place, and I can be more in the present moment with my child, and therefore more able to respond effectively. So to do that reframing, we talked about behavior, where it comes from, and what it means. We used the iceberg image to focus on the root cause of behavior, those messages and experiences beneath the surface of the water that can cause our children to feel upset and chaotic and dysregulated, which provokes the behaviors, which is what we see at the tip of the iceberg, all that we see. But it's those, it's what it is that that what we see, the behavior, is what tells us how our kids are doing. But it's that emotional internal state that informs us about where that behavior is coming from. So we can temporarily, at least, maybe completely, but temporarily, put that behavior aside, and what we want is to connect with that, with what we are, again, making assumptions about in terms of the emotional experiences and messages that our children have below the surface that are provoking that behavior. When we react to the behavior alone, which is what our culture tells us to do, usually by punishing, threatening, or yelling at it, all we do is make matters worse, and then the child has to get louder and more dramatic with the behavior in order to make us listen. Because they don't know what it is that's going on. They don't know why they're feeling the way they're feeling. All they're doing is responding in behavior. We also looked at how our expectations, some coming from our family of origin, are often unrealistic for our individual children. And to make them realistic, they need to be set so that our children can be successful meeting them before we raise the bar. So looking at what it is that we expect, seeing where those expectations come from, and is it working for our child? And if our child is not successful meeting those expectations, then we need to adjust them. And it doesn't mean lowering them, but that's often the result that we actually, but what we need to do is see what it is our child is capable of doing so that we can set expectations that can be met. Then we can start raising the bar once they're successful meeting them. So for some, that information is enough to allow us to switch our perceptions, turn things around, and see things from our child's point of view to get out of our fears and our catastrophizing in order to reach compassion and understanding. For others, and I would venture to say most of us, things still may feel stuck or even worse than ever. You might be tempted to get down on yourself because you haven't seen the changes you want so far. And again, I am going to encourage you to be patient. We still have a long way to go. And I have also gotten some nice success stories from some of you that things are changing, and that's all great. Annabelle, you have a question.
Sorry, Bonnie, it's just you've really faded out, but you've come back again. It just got very, very, so I couldn't hear you, but you I can hear you now.
Okay? Oh.
Yeah, just really faded out, so I absolutely couldn't hear you for a bit.
That's, all right, I'm going to unmute everybody for a second. Is that true for everybody?
No.
There was a little bit, but I could still hear you, but it did fade out a bit.
Huh. Okay, but it's back now.
Yeah, you're back. Yeah.
I don't know what I did, but I'm loud. So
okay.
That's weird. Okay, let's keep going. And if that happens again, I don't know what I can do about it, but let me know. All right, but I do want to ask you now if who has questions from part one. Any questions, any comments? I'd like to hear what's working, what's not working. So if you have any thoughts you want to share or places where you just say, I didn't get it about such and such. All right. I'm not seeing any hands raised, so I guess that means you all got it. Great. Well, there's plenty of time. All right, now people are raising their hands. All right, Sheila, what would you like to add here?
Okay, well, first off, I have had tremendous success, so I'm really happy, and I need to fill out your form. I haven't done it yet, but I'm really, really amazed at how things are better. I was so glad that I was being like the mom that I want to be by Mother's Day, you know. So that was really
how wonderful. What a nice Mother's Day present.
Yeah, it was really good. And my 7-year-old has told me that he loved me more in the last month than in his whole life. So
gosh.
Yeah, it's really great.
Isn't that great?
So that's the good news. And then something happened last night, and I really didn't know what to do. My husband goes to acting class on Monday night, and I got to do a 7-year-old and twin 4-year-olds at bedtime. So they were just getting up and running around, and my buttons, I was watching myself, and I was okay, and then they just kept getting up, and I couldn't, and I tried to do, like, positive reinforcement, okay, you know, like, when you stay in your bed, then, you know, something good is going to happen. I'm going to give you a prize or something. And then it was like, okay, now they just kept doing it, and I was completely felt, I could feel that old feeling coming back, and I was powerless.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I didn't know what to do, you know, so I just said, okay, you can't go swimming tomorrow. Okay, 2 days you can't go swimming. No television on the weekend. No swimming for a week. And, I mean, it's boiling where I am right now. So, and I'm thinking, oh, this is, you know, what are you doing? But finally, at no swimming for a week and no TV on the weekend, they got in their beds and they stayed there. But this was like an hour or an hour and a half later.
Okay. Well, let me say that hopefully where you're going to be able to move now is to connect with your kids instead of using the reward and punishment threats. Motivate them by offering a reward if they'll do what you want them to do, or punishing them, taking away a privilege, telling them they can't go swimming, whatever, if they don't do. That is, of course, what we're tempted to do, especially when you get in a situation like that where you feel powerless. You know, you just feel like, I don't know what to do to get them in bed. So they were just running around and jumping and having a good time?
Yes. I told them today, I said, I understand. It's fun to do that, but I didn't know where to go. It's like, well, but you got to go to bed because you got to grow. And you have to
right, right. Yeah.
They don't care about.
Yeah, and I hope that you will feel, as time goes on, more empowered to explain, to not explain, but to say, this is what needs to happen now without having to use reward and punishment. When you stay in that reward and punishment mode of thinking, then your kids get really manipulative with you. And, you know, it might be they're just feeling exuberant and excited and having fun, and maybe they're going to just see if they can push you far enough to offer something that they really want or to take something away. What is it you're going to do? So there is a transition and sometimes a big transition when the reward and punishment doesn't get pulled out. But it's really hard to think about what am I going to do when I don't use that, because those are the guns that we typically use, right? Yeah, to get our kids to do what we want. And if your kids have, you know, loved you more than ever now, they're going to really love you more than ever if you take away punishments and rewards. But I'm sure you're speaking for most everyone on this call, Sheila. The problem is that we don't feel strong enough as parents without those weapons. And that's what is something really, really important that we need to learn about ourselves, that we have this, that we can empower ourselves. And so there might be an evening. I mean, I don't know what was going on that evening, but maybe they're just having a ball and you give them an extra 5 minutes to bounce around and jump and play. Some kids have to get that energy out before they can settle down and relax. Were they doing anything that was, were they talking to you rudely? Were they telling you they're not going to listen to you, things like that?
No, they were having a lot of fun, and then they started running out to the kitchen to get something to eat, you know, like things that they weren't supposed to have because it's not dinner time.
Right.
But then that was I kind of was ready to go, yes, because that was just like, okay. If they were just staying in their room even, but when they started running around and then going out to the kitchen, that was not okay.
So do you have a kitchen is closed rule, a time when the kitchen is closed?
Yes.
You do?
Yes.
So at that time, you can just call that out, you know. The kitchen's closed, so as soon as everybody gets back in their room, then we can do such and such. How, you know, if you see that they're just, this is kind of an unusual situation, Sheila, that they're not going to bed when you, when your routine kind of leads them that way.
No, this is, bedtime is really hard.
It's always hard.
Because we have the twins, sometimes we put one on the couch, you know, just so, because, but then it just goes on, and they'll say, can I go back into my bed now? And it's like 9 o'clock sometimes. And
okay, so it sounds like maybe there is not a very, very firm structure for bedtime that you set.
Mm-hmm.
And that's clear to them. So
we have one. It's just that they ignore it. You know,
So sometimes during the day, like this afternoon, when they get home from school, sit down with all of them and say, we need to come up with a plan for bedtime because it's not working for me. You see, when you move into problem solving, and that's where we go, and I know we're not getting to it in this class because this is not as much a skills class. Maybe we can talk about doing something like that in the future. But when you move into problem solving, which is what replaces reward and punishment, which is the most important skill any of us can learn and teach our children, lifelong skills of being able to work out a problem. When you can do that, which means nobody is blamed, nobody's yelled at, nobody loses, everyone comes to an agreement. And I know it's hard with little kids, but this is when you want to start and kind of work up to it and stay with it. So the problem solving is a way of saying, what is it, this does not work for me. Bedtime does not work for me. Last night really did not work for me. I want to make a promise to you guys that from now on, and you got to, I'm saying this, you may not be ready for this, Sheila, but you've got to be really ready. I want to make a promise to you guys that we're not using punishment anymore. And I'm not taking away things. I'm not doing all that. However, what we do need to do is make agreements about things. So we're going to come up with a bedtime contract that we all agree to. And then talk to them and write it down. Write down a schedule and what they do at what time. And, you know, you can kind of lead it, but you want to make sure they're engaged in the process. So you could say something like, I want all of us to get upstairs at 7 o'clock. Would you like to have a bath or brush your teeth first? Who wants to get in pajamas? Who wants to, you know, that sort of thing. So you're kind of working out the plan. And then by 7:30, we're going to be reading books. And, you know, who's, maybe between the three of you, you can choose who's going to, you know, I mean, I'm making an overall thing here, which doesn't necessarily work with your kids, but it's the idea, you know, it's the,
okay,
how can we set this time-wise and what happens at what times to make it work for all of us. And when kitchen is closed, I want to make it very clear to all of you that that means kitchen is closed. So before you go upstairs, you make the call. Kitchen is going to close in 5 minutes. Does anybody need anything before we go upstairs? Because then the kitchen's closed. And maybe you have a marching song that you go up the stairs with, whatever. And really work it out at a time that is not bedtime. That's the important thing about this. And then get them upstairs. And then have the bedtime contract posted, maybe in the kitchen and in the bedroom, or in the two bedrooms. And then you can just point to it and say, what do we need to do next? What's coming next? And then maybe there's a night when there's an exception and we give playtime an extra 10 minutes or something like that. But I think when you work at it from that direction, they're going to be more cooperative with you. If they fear that they're not going to get something that they want, then they start getting manipulative, you know. And they know when they can kind of overpower you, right? Mm-hmm. And then you can also say, what do you think we should do if the contract is not followed? Or if somebody forgets and doesn't do this, and really let them tell you what they think should happen. And they're going to say something like, you know, take away swimming or something. And then you say, well, let's think about something that can happen in the moment. Does that give you a sense of somewhere you can go with this?
Yes, but what do you mean, something in the moment?
You really want to take your cues from them. So if if one of them says, you can tell us that we don't get to read books, or although I hate that as a consequence because
right.
I think reading is way too important. And then, but one of them might say that, and then you can say, well, I really want us to read books. So if you're not, and another thing you want to do is find out from them why they're, if they can tell you this afternoon why they weren't following the routine last night, why they aren't going to bed. Maybe the time to go to bed needs to be reevaluated. Maybe if you throw in an extra 15 minutes, you'll find it comes back in spades in cooperation. I don't know.
Okay.
All right.
Okay, thank you. I'll give it a try.
Okay. Anybody else? Teresa, I know you had your hand raised before. Did your question get answered? Wait a minute. I still have you on mute. Are you, did you want to say something?
Well, I was saying it's funny because it was exactly the same as Sheila's situation.
Oh, great. Oh, good.
it must be a really common button.
Oh, boy. Bedtime is a big one. Bedtime and getting out the door in the morning, I would say, they're the two biggies. Yeah.
Yeah, so that was really helpful. Thank you.
Okay, good. All right. So we will move on now into part two. So in part two, we're going to go back to see what life was like for us on the other side of the gap, when our parents got their buttons pushed and sent us those unintended messages that we believed about ourselves. These messages that we take in as little children grow into our buttons. Now, I want to make a note here. This is not about blaming our parents. This is whether you need to go through that stage is completely up to you. But this is not about blaming our parents, because I believe that every one of us does the best we can for our kids given the circumstances we're in, given the knowledge we have, given who we are as people. And we have learned so much more just in one generation about children's brains, what they need, what we all need. And we know so much more now than our parents did. And what I think is important to get to, kind of an end product, an end result of all this, is a place of acceptance, accepting our parents, so that when they say or do those little things that drive us crazy, instead of letting them push our buttons, instead of that creating, immobilization in us, we can just say, oh, that's mom, or there goes dad, doing that thing again. And that's a long process to get there for many people. For some, it's fine. It's not an issue. But when you have big, angry buttons, it's probably much harder to get to that place of acceptance. So anyway, I'm not blaming your parents. I don't think it's effective for you to blame your parents. What I blame is the culture that we have been living in for generations and generations and generations. And that is the culture of reward and punishment. And it is so difficult, even when we can make huge changes, like Sheila was just explaining. She's just feels so different in her parenting, and her kids are seeing it. Even still, the reward and punishment comes out when we get our buttons pushed, when we feel out of control and powerless in the face of these little children. So I think that there are certainly many of us out there who are working on ridding our culture of reward and punishment, but it's amazing how even when you may decide to stop punishing or rewarding, we still work in that mindset. The mindset is still very hard to switch out of. So, I often use the image of the Oregon Trail, that trail of wagons, that endless trail of wagons that just kept going west, going west, going west. And if any of you have been to places where you can still see the tracks, it's pretty amazing. You can stand in the tracks, sometimes up to your knees or more. And imagine, this is just an image that I always keep in my head, to change out of the reward and punishment culture of parenting, which is what keeps us in those tracks, just following the one in front of us, just going the same way. To change means having to turn very flimsy wagon wheels out of those deep, deep ruts and starting a new path. And that's why I just think parents who take this on are tremendously courageous and wonderful, because we're the ones who are going to change our culture. And it is like swimming upstream. It is very, very, very difficult to do. So it requires a 180-degree change in perception of what our children are about, what they're doing, what they're not doing. So this is kind of the beginning. The buttons work is the beginning of all of that, so we can turn that perception around. Okay, I would like you all to write this down in your workbook. The value we perceive our parents placed on us is the value we place on ourselves. I'll say that again. The value we perceive being the most important word, The value we perceive our parents placed on us is the value we place on ourselves. Now think about that gap again. On the parent side of the gap, when we were talking about it to begin with, you are trying to teach your child something with all best intentions, right? An admirable lesson. However, when your buttons get pushed, that lesson gets distorted and it sends the child a message about himself. I'm unlovable. I'm not good enough. I'm not okay. Mommy doesn't love me. That's not what you're sending. That is never in a million years what you would intend to send. But that's what the child perceives. So, when we're thinking now of ourselves on the other side of that gap from our parents, we're, in our child minds, we are perceiving things about ourselves that our parents are telling us, even though from their perspective, they're just trying to teach us a good lesson. They're afraid that we're not going to do well, and so they're going to threaten us with this and punish us with this and all that. So perceive is the operative word here. So those values don't change from the time we decided in that little child mind what those values placed on us were, whether we're worthless, invisible, the glue that holds everyone together, the competent one, the incompetent one. We take them in most likely in our first 6 years, because in the first 6 years of a child's life, our brains, our consciousness is like, it just absorbs everything in the environment. So what's coming at us from the environment is imprints on our brains like data on software. Because in the first 6 to 7 years of life, children don't have the cognitive ability to analyze what's coming at us, to say, oh, no, Mommy, you're not right. That it's not that I'm being mean. It's that I just want that toy. They can't do that. So not until about 7 does a child have the cognitive ability to say, oh, Daddy's just having a bad day. This isn't about me. You know, give or take a few years, depending on a child's maturity. So those messages stay with us, and they remain unless we deal with them, which we're doing now. And let me tell you why they stay. There is a woman named Jill Bolte Taylor who has written a book called My Stroke of Insight. Jill is a brain scientist, and you may have seen her. She did a quite famous TED Talk a while ago where she came on stage holding a human brain. She, at age 33, was a very renowned brain scientist, at which time she had a massive stroke, a stroke that took her 8 years to recover from. And she knew so much about the brain that when that stroke happened, she knew what parts of her brain were shutting down and what was going to come next. Amazing. It's a very interesting book, My Stroke of Insight. But as I'm reading it, she has this wonderful page here that just I have copied, and I read every time I teach this class now. So in her first chapter, she's explaining for most of us brains for dummies the brain and how it works. She says, the limbic system functions by placing an affect or emotion on information streaming in through our senses. Because we share these structures with other creatures, The limbic system cells are often referred to as the reptilian brain or the emotional brain. When we're newborns, these cells become wired together in response to sensory stimulation. It's interesting to note that although our limbic system functions throughout our lifetime, it does not mature. And I'm adding this, it's the only part of our brain that doesn't. It's where the amygdala lies in the middle. Back to her quote, as a result, when our emotional buttons are pushed, we retain the ability to react to incoming stimulation as though we were a two-year-old, even when we are adults. Isn't that amazing? So we react in exactly the same way we would have reacted as a two-year-old to that emotional memory. So that's the bad news. Then she goes on to say, as our higher cortical cells mature and become integrated in complex networks with other neurons, we gain the ability to take new pictures of the present moment. When we compare the new information of our thinking mind with the automatic reactivity of our limbic mind, we can reevaluate the current situation and purposefully choose a more mature response. And that's what we're doing now. We're going to take new pictures of those old emotional memories. Now, a lot of parents say to me right off the bat, and I'm sure many of you feel the same way, that you can't remember your childhood. You can't remember a lot of these situations. Don't worry about that. It's very common, and we'll find ways to get to some for instances. Any thoughts about that?
Hi, this is Rebecca.
Hi, Rebecca. Okay.
So my question is, I have a 4.5-year-old, and she wears a pull-up at night, and twice she pooped in her pull-up, which first time I didn't do anything. I just pretended it didn't happen, but we just got cleaned up and went on with our day, and then it happened this morning, and I didn't get mad at her, but I was mad that I was trying to hold it in, but I just said, you know, we don't poop in our pull-up, you're old enough, and so I think I kind of shamed her. I didn't mean to. And I don't know what to do in that situation. I was at a total loss.
Well, she's got a pull-up on for that reason, right? So
She was awake when she pooped. So it was rather than going to the bathroom, she decided to stay in her room and poop in her pull-up. I mean,
yeah.
She knows how to use the bathroom. It's just during the night we wear a pull-up because she's not waking up at night to go to the bathroom.
I really wouldn't make anything of it. I would just let her kind of go ahead with this, and you might look for the roots of a little bit of stress. If it continues, it might have something to do with some stress, but you know, I think it's not anything to make a big deal out of.
Okay.
Kinda, you know, and I think it's hard, especially when it hasn't happened in a long time. And I think your response would only be, oh, look, you pooped in your pull-up. Isn't that strange? You usually poop in the potty. And kind of leave it at that.
Okay.
Okay?
Okay, thank you.
All righty. And Nicole?
Yes, hi, Bonnie.
Hi.
I just had kind of a comment/question about what you were talking about with the brain science. My husband and I both kind of had, his was less tumultuous and just way more just strict, and my childhood was very tumultuous and chaotic. It just scares me to even hear that. Like, you know, because we both have issues. Like, how do you, it just makes me feel, I guess, a little bit more hopeless that it's ingrained in me. And I know all the mistakes I made when my girls were two, there, you know, or when they were littler. Did I just, like, wire their brains wrong and now it's going to be that much harder because it's not just me and him, or it's not just my daughters that I have to think about changing the patterns for. It's myself and my husband, and he's not always willing.
Yeah,
so,
I know. And this is you know, always what comes up in this, and it is so true of most of us. And, you know, the reason I bring it into the course is because it's just really important, I think, for us to know this so that we can stop passing it on. And I do believe that it is never, ever too late. And what is important, Nicole, I'm going to put you on mute because I'm getting a little feedback.
Okay.
So let me just see if that, okay. It's very important for us to not go down that tunnel, and I know I've just sort of presented it to you, but not go down that tunnel of feeling hopeless, because I do believe that at any age, and what we know now about the brain is how incredibly plastic it is and how important it is for us to look at this and bring it up and take responsibility for it. And that's what part two is going to be about. It's going to be about, not that we have to remember everything that happened to us, not that we have to get discouraged and despairing about all these things that happened, but that we can take responsibility for it and not pass it on to our children. And I really believe that when we can make the changes now, even if our kids are well past the first 6 or 7 years, you are going to change all those neurons for your kids too. And you will be amazed at the changes that can happen. So I really encourage you to stay with it. And I know that I also hear this all the time. You know, it's, my husband doesn't want to go there. My husband doesn't want to do this. And it makes it harder for you, but I still think you can make big changes, and you can show your children a model of someone who takes responsibility. And it doesn't mean that you have to share with your children everything that happened to you, but it does mean you're not going to react from those places unconsciously. Your dimmer switch is going to be raised to a place where you can understand what your temptations are, when you can turn things around. Does that help in any way, Nicole?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay. And just the other quick comment I had was, I feel like a lot of the times, and just since I've taken your first part of the course, I've been trying, when issues come up with me and my husband, trying to use the button analysis on what's going on with me and him.
Yeah.
My problem is I feel a little bit resentful. Like, I can get geared up to do it for my kid because I feel like that's my baby, that, you know, but when I feel like I have to do it for him, I'm at the point right now, and I'm still pushing myself to do it, but my initial reaction is resentment. Like, why do I have to do it? Why do I have to, you know,
absolutely,
do this for him? And it just really
totally
pushes me.
I totally agree. I identify with that. I found it much easier to do with my kids
as
well.
Yeah.
Just stick with it. And know that, you know, one thing that I think I've learned is that when I find myself thinking about my husband, if only you would do such and such, why can't you blah, 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 it's always about me.
Mm-hmm.
It always comes back to something that my husband is reflecting about me. So think about it that way. That's no fun, I know. But I know, I go into, you're old enough to know better. Yeah, yeah. And I don't know what to tell you about that.
I know. It just is hard, and that's what it is.
It is hard, yeah.
Yeah. So it's worth
okay.
it for sure.
All right. Thanks for that. And is this Sabina? No. Who? I just unmuted someone who has anonymous in the caller.
Hello?
Yes.
Okay, Bonnie, it's Jennifer.
Jennifer, hi.
Yes, hi. The question that I had was about the quote that you read off. Can you explain a little bit more about the picture, what we're changing? I understand everything we've talked about is expectations and kind of our belief systems about ourselves and what we expect from ourselves and our kids. Is that what we're changing in that by the term picture when we're changing that?
Good question.
Or is it also the memories? Like, because obviously we have these memories. Or is it the perception of the memories? Do you see what I'm saying? I'm getting confused with that.
Yes. Yes to all of this. Yes, it is. It is your the memories are going to be there. The experiences we had are always going to be there. What is going to change is how those memories drive us. When we can pull it out, it's like what we can do, and hopefully we're going to all be able to do this, is pull out these memories from these beliefs that we have about ourselves and take a look at it. And in doing, we are raising our awareness about what happened. So when I can see what I took in from my mother when she said such and such to me over and over again, then I can also turn it around and see how important it is that I not do that with my child, or I not even have the same expectations that were had of me, blah, blah, blah. So what I'm doing is looking back at that old memory that I stored in what I call the attic of our minds. So when we take those in as little children, those messages, we put them into our subconscious mind. We don't want to run around thinking I'm awful, nobody loves me, I'm worthless. So they go kind of back into our subconscious mind as unresolved feelings. And we design our lives as best we can so those old wounds don't become exposed and vulnerable to cause us pain. And we're really good at behaving defensively and taking on certain patterns of behavior to protect ourselves from that pain that we felt, you know, at those times. And we can become even extremely high-functioning. We can become president of the United States. Until we have children, and when we have children, those old feelings of being unloved or a disappointment get triggered. And so what we want to realize is that those feelings that come up in us, think about the emotional chain reaction, that behavior provokes assumptions, which we often don't even realize right away, but we sure do go to those feelings right away. Those feelings have more to do with our past than with our child's present. So our yelling and threatening and punishing are our protective mechanisms, which actually can become addictive. So we protect ourselves in this mode of defensive reactions to our children. Okay, so I know I'm not completely answering your question. So we have, when we can see that, all right, now I've put all this together. I know I hate these reactions. All right, these reactions come from assumptions I'm making. These assumptions I'm making that my child is not listening and is never going to listen to anybody and never be able to hold down a job, and all my fears come up, then when I kind of get in the practice, I know that this is all coming from a deeper place. This is way more about me than it is about my child. And when you can go there, when you have done the work here in this course to bring out where that fear came from, you know, perhaps some message that you got from your parent about how you have to perform, or otherwise you're gonna flunk, you're gonna fail, you're gonna whatever. And that is what is triggering. That is what is getting triggered and is triggering your reactions. So when you become more aware of it, it's not that that goes away, but it's that you can put it aside more. It doesn't drive you in the same way. Those old experiences and memories don't drive you when you are aware of them. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does make sense.
Okay.
Yes. In fact, it what I was thinking when you were saying this is some part of me was saying, well, I thought I was done with that. Like, I feel like I've worked through so many things from my past.
Right.
But you're so right. When I became a parent, it was a whole, it's as if in some ways I start over, and I don't even realize that these responses come out. The other day, I have a 3.5-year-old. I was my expectations were huge. I mean, it was almost like I was expecting her to almost be an adult.
Yes.
And
right.
And it came out of me so fast. And, you know, in the moment when I had that expectation, I felt justified. So very
yes.
justified.
Yes,
and
absolutely.
It took me days to come down off of that experience and realize how ridiculous that was. And because of the course, I actually did draw it back to the expectations that were put on me that were unrealistic, and realized that, you know, my parents were coming through my mouth. And but so I hear exactly what you're saying, and that just reaffirms my experience. So thank you.
Great. Okay. Excellent. So I think what Jennifer is pointing out is this process that you're going to go through, which is not an easy one. You start recognizing what you're doing first, and that's where it often feels like, oh my God, I feel worse than ever. This is terrible. This is hopeless, because suddenly your awareness is heightened about what you're doing. And I suspect that Jennifer might not have even recognized that she held on to what she held on to for several days before the course, before her dimmer switch went up a little bit. So the more we uncover, the more that dimmer switch is going to go up, the more you're going to recognize, the more you're going to say, oh, wait a minute, hold on here, this isn't my child's fault, this is what's coming from me. And as you practice, there's going to be this just softening around the edges of what it is that's driving you. It doesn't mean you're never going to get your buttons pushed again. But when you do, and that particular button is just maybe going to get pushed, but it's not going to drive you to insanity. It's not going to drive you to that place where your parents come out of your mouth. So, all right, I hope that's clear. I want to also tell you about Dr. Dan Siegel's description of the brain. Dan Siegel is fabulous. If any of you know him, he's the author of many books on the child's brain. You may know his book Parenting from the Inside Out, which was quite a number of years ago, And his most recent book, I think it's his most recent, is The Whole Brain Child. So, and his work is all focused for parents, too. So if you want to learn more about this, I highly recommend his work, Dan Siegel. He has introduced us to this wonderful little thing that I think it's great because, again, it's a visual. It's something we can do. So what I want you to do is make a fist and with your thumb inside your fingers. So your thumb is against the palm of your hand. Your fingers are wrapped around your thumb. And just hold your forearm up straight so that fist is out in front of you. Your forearm represents your brain stem. Around the wrist area is where the brain stem meets with the brain. And the lower part of your hand is the limbic system, which we were talking about earlier with Jill Bowlby Taylor's work. Within that limbic system is the amygdala. So your thumb represents the amygdala. And the amygdala is that old part of the brain that never matures. That's the one that stores those emotional memories, right? So, and your fingers that are wrapped around the amygdala represent the back part of your hand and fingers represents your cortex. The top part of your fingers that are wrapped completely down to your palm are is your prefrontal cortex, right? Your cortex is the thinking part of your brain. That is where your rationale happens. The prefrontal cortex does not fully mature until we are about 25 years old. And that is really important to remember when we're thinking about teenagers and risky behavior and all of that. It is actually evolutionarily appropriate, the risky behavior that teenagers get into. But they're not quite as, which is another reason why I think problem solving is so important to do with children, because the more you problem solve with young children, the more that prefrontal cortex is activated. And so the less risky behavior they will engage in when they're teenagers. All right, anyway, back to the model here. So the amygdala, when we get triggered, and as Dan Siegel says, when our buttons get pushed, we flip our lids. So what I want you to do now is keep your thumb where it is and stretch your fingers up straight. That is what happens when we get our buttons pushed. Our cortex goes offline for that period of time that our buttons are pushed. It is unable to reason at that time. When those emotional memories get triggered and we're not aware of it and we just let it drive us, we get into that place where Jennifer just explained it feels so justified because we're working on just in that emotional memory place. Now, after we calm down, what we're trying to do with learning how to diffuse our buttons is to bring that cortex back online, wrap those fingers back around your amygdala so you can be rational again. That's why it is very important that you don't react when your button is pushed, when you know that's happening. And we talked about those various things, the physical sensations that we have, that it's very important to make sure that those reactions don't take over. So stop. Just, you know, walk away, don't say anything, bite your tongue, whatever, because the very best you can do in a moment like that, when your cortex is offline, the very best you can do is be totally ineffective, and the worst is damaging. So very important to not react. Now, we all know how hard that is, especially, as Jennifer said, especially when it feels so justified. It feels good. It feels, yes, I have a right to scream at you. And that is part of the process, recognizing that, recognizing how, what that feels like. And, again, be patient with yourself and don't get, I know it doesn't make any sense to say don't worry about what's happening to your child, but the most important thing here is your work on yourself. I totally 100% believe that. As you work on yourself, you are going to have different responses to your children, and that's all going to just start to fall in line. But it takes a while, so be patient. Yes, Teresa.
Hi, Bonnie.
Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to quickly say that something you just said just made a huge difference for me, because ignoring or just saying, you know, I'm going to put their behavior to the side and deal with myself.
Mm-hmm.
For me, because one of my biggest motivators is feeling responsible. So, again, in the moment, I feel justified. But if I can, just say, I'm going to just deal with myself. I don't have to, they're not going to be, you know, horribly irresponsible people for the rest of their lives if my, you know, daughter doesn't brush her teeth and go to bed right now.
Exactly.
Like,
exactly.
I just realized, you know, I can just, if I can just say, you know what, just not tonight. It's okay. I'm going to deal with myself.
Yes.
That makes a huge difference because I catastrophize and I just project right into the future and everything is just from that day forward, it's going to be exactly like that. Like it's going to be bad. That's the way I think when I'm in that mindset. So just giving myself permission to stop and not worry about correcting anything. Not that it needs to be corrected, but in my mind at the time, it feels justified and it needs to be corrected. So thank you.
Right. So just, and it's about having compassion for yourself. You know, the thing about looking at children's behavior and seeing, wait a minute, they're not being a problem, they're having a problem, which takes us to compassion. We need to do that for ourselves too. When we go offline, when we flip our lids, when we lose it, it means we're having a problem, right? And when we're having a problem, we need to take care of ourselves.
Yeah, and I'm sure as we'll get into it, one of my, the homework, the belief section was huge for me because I realized basically that I taking care of myself has been my least, like I've been at the bottom of the barrel my entire life as far as I'm concerned. So realizing that I can do that. I should probably go.
Okay.
Background. But thank you,
Bonnie. All right. We will get to that right away now. Okay. Thanks, Teresa. I hope that was helpful to a lot of people. I think that was really powerful, what she said. Yes, you want to take care of yourself. In that moment of reactivity, you are the one who needs care. Your child will be fine. So, let's get to the workbook now. Anytime anybody has a question, just raise your hand. On page 25 and 26, which are the first couple of pages of your part two, these are basically just for you to look at, and they're just kind of different ways of looking at the same chart of how our beliefs fuel everything else that ends up in our reactions. So did anyone do any work on filling in the boxes on page 26? It's not easy. I certainly didn't expect you to do that. I just wondered if anybody went ahead and did that. There are some examples here. Now, the examples don't always make perfect sense to you because we come from all kinds of different directions. So they're just some ideas to to get you thinking about, if you start with your assumption and then look at the expectation. So let's look at the first one. She never listens. The expectation, she should listen and do what I say when I say it. That's my expectation. I realize that. That comes from a standard that I was brought up with that say children should be seen and not heard, which means they should always do as they are told. And possibly a belief that is underneath all of that is whatever I want doesn't matter. I have no mind of my own. So that's just, you might come back to this later on when you get a little clearer about beliefs. Now, I think what Teresa was talking about is page 28, I'm not sure, but there's also another practice there on page 27, looking, you're encouraging your witness self, and that's what we're talking about here in terms of recognizing, taking responsibility, looking at what it is we're doing. You've got to recognize what you're doing right now, good or bad, before you can really get into recognizing what's provoking that, what is, you know, what those deeper feelings are. So take a look at that. Page 28 is a list of some of the common limiting beliefs from other parents in my groups. And this list is just meant to get you thinking about your own. And when you go over this, I'd like you to check off any that apply to you and then add your own at the bottom as well. Yes, Alana.
I'm sorry. I'm looking at my workbook, and my page 28 is just the notes.
Do you have workbook part for part two?
Yeah, and it starts from page 30. When I print it out, on the bottom it says page 30.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Huh. I wonder if you didn't. Would other people raise their hands if that's true for them? Star two? I wonder if your printer just didn't print out the first two pages.
Okay.
Do you still have that? Do you still have that page with the workbook link?
Yeah. So just
maybe
read.
Maybe you should give it another try printing it
so
out.
So page 28 should say what now?
It should say part two up at the top. Some common childhood limiting beliefs.
Okay.
And then there is a long list of beliefs, and then down at the end it says add your own.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Okay, and you'll have a couple of pages before that, too.
Okay. Thank you.
Practice. Okay. So take a look at that. It's just kind of to stir things up for you. Isn't this fun? You love working with me, right? It stirs it all up. It's so much fun. but see if any apply to you. And hopefully it's going to get your thinking going so you can maybe write down your own. Again, you might want to come back to this as we do further work. Now, what I would like is to look at page 29. And, Alana, I guess you don't have this either. It's a list of questions, the steps to identifying the beliefs that drive you. Might I have a volunteer who will go through this with me as I lead you? Would anyone like to do this with me? All right. Annabelle, would you like to do this?
Yeah, I had trouble with some of it nearer the end, but
you've done it already.
Oh yeah, no, I thought we had to.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
So, I'll read what I've got, and maybe you can help me as I go along.
Okay.
Okay. So, what behaviors, type of behaviors push my buttons? Well, whining, rudeness, laziness, not taking responsibility, fighting limits. I mean, I could go on. Lying, cruelty, not doing what he's told, ignoring me or my limits.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, what gets triggered in me when that happens? How do I feel? I feel irritation, anger, hopelessness, powerlessness.
Okay.
Does your child remind you of anyone when this happens? He reminds me of his father, who I'm not with. I'm a single mom. My brother and my sister.
Ex-spouses always come up on this one. On that
yeah. Some of the things that come out of his mouth are just like his father. Okay.
Uh-huh.
What are you afraid of will happen if you don't stop it right away? Well, I catastrophize. He'll always be this way. Oh, my God, it's establishing negative neural pathways and patterns. He won't learn, and ultimately, therefore, he won't be loved. And I will have failed. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
I'm just writing that one down. I just got that one. I will have failed as a mum, you know.
Right.
Okay, that's a big one. What would either of your parents have done if you had behaved this way? If you're not sure, make it up. I can't remember much.
Before you go on with this, let me just say to everyone, the reason I say here, if you're not sure, make it up, it's because so many of us don't have old memories. And when you make it up, you are going very close to that place. So
mm-hmm.
what you make up is probably pretty accurate. So what were you going to say?
Okay, so I've put here I'd be told off. The main thing I get is I would have been very disapproved of, because I've got a big thing about being disapproved of and being I'm very sensitive to criticism.
Okay.
My mother was quite a critical woman. So I would have been told off, I would have been highly disapproved of, possibly sent to my room, told to stop, to be quiet and to be good. And that's kind of like not what good girls do, that kind of thing.
Right.
What did I hear on the other side of the gap when this happened? Or guess I might have heard. Yeah, what I would have heard was you're a naughty girl, that wasn't very nice, that was spiteful, that's not kind.
I'm
you know, be quiet, stop showing off.
I'm
yeah.
a huge disappointment, yeah.
Yeah, you're a disappointment, yeah. Okay, I'll write that down.
So say the same thing starting with I. What you hear on the other side of the gap.
Oh, okay, what did I? Okay, so I'm a naughty girl.
Right.
I'm not very nice. I'm spiteful.
Mm-hmm.
I'm too noisy. I'm too much is a big one I've got. I'm too much. You know, I'm a nuisance. I shouldn't show off.
Right.
Something like that.
Which can, if it goes deep enough, could lead to, you know, I shouldn't show off. I should be invisible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, something like that.
Kind of goes to those children should be seen and not heard places.
Yeah, well, it was a bit like that. We had a nursery and, you know, we had to ask to go into the sitting room, that sort of thing. Okay, what is the message I took in about myself? I am not welcome. I must be good. I must please others to get love and approval. I'm not good enough. I've got to get it right. But all those sorts of things.
Yeah, yeah.
They're big ones. I've got to get it right. Got to get it right. That's a kind of mantra almost.
Oh, boy, how that drives us today.
Yeah. We're all. It's very common, I know.
You've got to get it right with your children because
if
you don't, they're going to be a mess and you're going to fail.
Yes, exactly. Self-fulfilling prophecy. So how does this affect my expectations of my child? I got a bit stuck with these last two questions. What I've put here is I feel impotent, so I need him to obey me.
Mm-hmm.
He needs to be obedient and good and compliant.
To validate you.
Yeah.
Because if you feel worthless, or impotent, you need your children to behave a certain way because they are. We see our children as reflections of us, and if your children are doing well, that's a stamp of approval.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And you can get the Best Mother Award. And so it becomes really important that your children get it right.
Yeah, exactly. And an example of that, if I may just quickly say that, he just wouldn't have a shower last night. He hasn't had a shower for about a week. And his hair was really greasy.
I hear that a lot.
I
hear that a lot.
And his hair was really greasy, and it was just my thought of, oh, my God, he's going to go to school with really greasy hair, and what will people think? And
mm-hmm.
I mean, it's ridiculous. Oh, anyway, okay, so with this understanding, how might my expectations change? I kind of got a bit stuck here. I got stuck.
So what... So if you are expecting your kids to get it right all the time.
Yeah.
Those were sort of my words, but I think that's kind of where you would be logical for you to go, that they have to do it right.
Yeah, and get it right and be a certain way and
Yeah, okay. So you're going to, probably in some ways they can meet those expectations, in some ways they can't.
Yeah.
And we're talking about your 13-year-old, right?
Yeah, he's new. Yeah, almost 13, yeah.
Right. So you want to adjust your expectations to be appropriate for your son, who is almost 13.
Yeah.
So in terms of cleanliness, for instance.
In terms of what, sorry?
Cleanliness, for instance.
Yeah.
Is this important to him?
It doesn't seem to be.
Right.
I mean, it's like the cleaning the room thing, isn't it? Yeah.
His agenda is very, very, very different. Now, soon, it probably will be important to him to be clean.
But right now, he really, really doesn't care.
So there's a new expectation, an adjusted expectation. Right now, my son doesn't care about getting his body clean, about personal hygiene. So therefore, when you have that expectation of him, that is not on his care list, right? He doesn't care. So then, where does that take you? Right
well,
now,
I can let go of it, actually. I can.
Yeah.
I can let go of it. I mean, I did last night. I just, you know. I won't go into the whole story because I know it's taking time. But
that's
I did let go of it.
So some things you're going to let go of, and some things you're going to just kind of have a different reaction to.
Yeah.
Maybe you'll know that for this period of time, it's something you need to remind him to do, or it's something you need to ask, that you need to acknowledge that it's your problem that he's not doing this, not his, because he doesn't care about it. And you're basically asking him to help you with your problem.
Yeah.
Because it's not, you know, rather than seeing... Oh, my God, if he doesn't do this, he's going to stink for the rest of his life. Nobody's ever going to love him. He's never going to.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Where we go when we don't get conscious of it.
Mm.
You know, and it's often we say things like that and we end up laughing.
Yeah. I mean, I did say to him, look, I know this is my problem. I need you to be clean, you know. My fear is that the other kids will laugh at you at school or something or make comments about you, you know, and I own that it was
my
stuff.
See if you can change your word need to want. I want you to be clean. You don't need to be clean. Your existence doesn't depend on him being
clean. I want you to be clean. Okay. I'm just writing it down.
All right.
Yeah.
I'm going to we've
thank
got
you, Bonnie.
I'm going to all right.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot. All right. How about Nicole?
Hi, Bonnie.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing okay.
Did you do this, or do you want to just kind of go through it with me?
Yeah, I actually didn't do it, so I was going to just go through it with you.
So in hearing Annabelle's, what behaviors push your buttons?
When they don't like something I've told them to do or asked them to do,
okay.
when they fight with each other. And so those are the two major things. When they're showing me disapproval of something and when they're fighting with each other.
Okay. And what gets triggered in you when that happens? How do you feel?
I feel just powerless and like I'm screwing up and like nervous and if it doesn't go away, then it turns into rage. I feel angry and stressed.
Okay. And does your child or your children remind you of anyone?
In some ways, they remind me of myself, except that I wouldn't do half of the stuff that they do.
Right. Okay. But there's something in there. And
yes.
Maybe... just the way you said that, there's a possibility that maybe there's a wish that you could have, but your parents wouldn't let you. Something
right.
like that. Yeah. So what are you afraid will happen if you don't stop it right away?
That I'm setting a pattern and that it's almost like I feel like I'm going to be found out that I am, in fact, a failure.
Uh-huh.
Like, okay, proven, you know.
Right. And what would your parents have done if you had behaved this way?
Beat me, screamed at me, definitely made me feel
unloved. What was the second? Beat you what?
Scream. Scream
mm-hmm.
at me
screamed
or
at you.
Make me feel unloved.
Yeah. It's, you know, when our parents react in ways like that, that is hugely motivating to behave the way your parents want you to, right?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
You don't want to be beaten. You don't want to be screamed at. You don't want to be treated like that. So that's why it stays there. It stays in us. If I threaten my child, he's not going to want that, so he's going to do what I ask him to do.
Yeah.
And the question is, at what cost?
Right.
You know, do you want your child to be going through these questions when he's your age? The motivator for you, for all of us, was fear.
Mm-hmm.
You were very afraid of getting beaten. You were very afraid of getting yelled at and called names, right? So we're in this place now where we don't want to bring our children up on fear, and so it's like, what do we do instead?
Yeah.
Okay. What did you hear on the other side of the gap?
You're not good enough. That you have to be perfect, you know, or we're going to be mad at you. Definitely what others think is more important than what you think or feel. And also, in an ironic way, see, I was the youngest of 13, and by the time I was around, I was only with my father for about 5 years, so my older siblings got most of the physical abuse. So they all tell me I had it easy. So I kind of laughed when I saw this one on there because it's true, but it's ridiculous.
Right, and it's all relative.
Yeah, and it's just nuts. But yeah. And also, so it was kind of me and my mom at the end, and I was the one to be counted on. I was the one to keep the house clean, make everything perfect so she wouldn't be upset, and because I knew she was going through hard times. So all that
right.
kind of thing. Just not ever right. feeling beaten up, and it had to be perfect.
Right. So the message you took in about yourself
that I wasn't good enough.
Yeah. And how does this affect your expectations today of your child?
I think it drives me to try and make them be perfect.
Right.
Because that'll make me feel perfect.
Right. And how might you change that?
Well, it's definitely started to change since I've taken the course, the first part, and just to relax and to lighten up and to accept their feelings for what they are and not feel like I have to own them or I have to be a part of them, even just accept them and be more empathetic.
That's great. So you see how we are asking our children to take care of our problems.
Yeah.
You know, in all of these, we're telling them that if they don't behave, then we're going to be a wreck, and it's their responsibility. That's basically the underlying message we give them. So, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
All right. We're out of time, but I think I would like to do one more. So, is this Sabina?
Hello?
Yes.
Hi.
Yes. Hi.
So I did not do the exercise.
Okay. Is this Sabina?
Yes, it is. It's Sabina.
Okay.
Yep.
That's Sabina. All right. Let's go through it then quickly.
Okay.
What behaviors push your buttons?
Okay. So not listening, ignoring. He's almost four, and I find that there's a little bit of lying starting. So that I don't like that at all. Hitting, not
okay,
eating.
Okay, let me just throw a little thing, a little lesson in here. Take the word, you're talking about a three-year-old?
Yeah, he's going to be four in July, so he's close to four.
Anywhere up until, I don't know, 10 or 12, take the word lying
out
of your vocabulary, out of your expectation, out of your assumption. Children lie for only a few reasons. One is it's all about protecting themselves. Change it to he's not telling you the truth.
Okay.
Lying is something that adults put a serious meaning on it.
Okay.
And so when we assume that our little child is lying, it's taken us down a really bad pathway.
Okay.
So children lie because they're afraid they're going to get in trouble. Now here I'm saying it. They don't tell the truth about something because either they are afraid they're going to get in trouble if they do, which is why it's so important to take that out of the equation.
Okay.
So your children know they are never going to get in trouble. See what amazing things that alone does. The other reason is because they don't want you to be disappointed in them. And so they don't want you to know something that they're afraid you're going to think badly of them about. So that's just my little lesson on lying there, okay?
Okay, I've taken it off the list.
Well, but it's important to, just reframe it. That's all. Okay.
Hitting, not eating, talking back, and it seems to be minor, but I find it very tiring. He renegotiates all the time. If I say, this is what we're going to do tonight, we're going to do A, B, and C, he'll renegotiate and twist it around, and sometimes it's no big deal, and I say, okay, that's fine. But sometimes it's like it offsets the whole schedule for the evening.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, I'll say, okay, we're going to go home, we're going to eat. You're going to have a bath, we'll read, and then if there's still some time, maybe you can watch some TV. He'll say, no, we're going to, I want to watch TV, and he'll redo the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. I think that's great.
I do. When it's happening, I think, wow, he's pretty.
Right. You've got a problem solver on your hands. However,
it's just, I find it very exhausting.
Yeah,
sometimes.
Of course. And your part of it is that doesn't work for me.
Okay.
Right? So it just because he's negotiating with you, which means he's very smart, doesn't mean you have to go with what he's telling you.
Yeah. Sometimes
you know?
I think, okay, it doesn't matter if we do A, C, and B. It's no big deal to me.
Exactly.
And then I say, yeah, okay, that's fine.
Yes. But when it doesn't work for you, say, sorry, that doesn't work for me.
Yeah.
We need to go back to the drawing board here.
But sometimes it's too late. Sometimes it's like if we don't do the eating, and then when the procrastination with the eating,
mm-hmm.
and eating turns out to be an hour and it started off late,
well, and
then it starts to get...
There's a time that when it ends.
Yeah.
You know? And if you're afraid he's going to go to bed hungry and that means you're abandoning him and you're a terrible mother, you see, if that pushes your button, then you can't do that.
Yeah.
But if he's going to be fine. So being firm, saying, okay, time is over for eating, then the next time he'll get his eating done.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, sometimes he'll go away from the table, and I'll say, don't ask for a snack. This is, if you're hungry later, this is what you're eating.
Mm-hmm.
And he has to go back and finish his food. Like, I'll warm it up, but I'm not giving him treats or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. Okay. Where were we on this?
So, okay. What gets triggered in you?
Right.
I feel powerless, tired, and then eventually it'll be angry.
Right. Okay. And does he remind you of anyone?
Sometimes me, sometimes my brother. That's about it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a single mother by choice, so I don't know his father.
Okay. All right. That way you can always put it off on him. On the What are you afraid will happen if you don't stop it right away?
If we take, for instance, hitting, mm-hmm. I'd be worried that he's going to turn into a bully.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
For that one.
All right. And what, let's just stay with that.
Sure.
What would either of your parents have done if you had
there were kind of more defined roles for boys and girls wouldn't have really hit. Girls didn't hit.
So what would have happened to you if
I did, I would have probably gotten in a lot of trouble.
Yeah, what would that look like?
I probably would have gotten hit.
Hit?
Yeah, I probably would have gotten hit.
Right. So isn't that interesting that we teach children not to hit by hitting?
Yes.
Yeah. So what did you hear on the other side of the gap?
Pretty much girls did not hit.
Right, yeah.
That's not ladylike, or that wouldn't have been ladylike.
Yeah. And so the message you took in about yourself?
Message when I
try and maybe an I should see where that leads you
about that I should not hit.
Let's see.
I shouldn't be aggressive.
What about being a girl? There's a big one there. If your parents had these very defined roles of boys and girls.
It would just, like, they, you know, you would know your that you just shouldn't do that. It wasn't ladylike.
Yeah. So if you weren't ladylike, what would you be?
I'd be like a boy.
Uh-huh. And it was okay for boys?
I think it would have been more accepted if you were a male.
Okay. So it would be...
I'm not going to say condoned.
Yeah.
They wouldn't have, you know, they wouldn't have enforced it. They wouldn't have...
But girls don't. Girls aren't aggressive.
Mm-hmm. Right?
And I think that's probably an important one there. Girls don't show aggression.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, we have this thing going on in society now that if men are aggressive, it means they're powerful and moving up the ladder and doing all the right thing. If women are aggressive, they're bitches. And that's a major cultural thing we have happening. Can you get to this one now? How does this affect your expectations?
I don't expect my son to be aggressive at all. I don't want him to hit. I don't want him to deal with people hitting him that way. I want him to remove himself and say, like, please don't do that to me. And remove
right.
yourself is what I tell him.
Right. And is he able to meet that expectation?
Well, so he's in daycare, right? So I'm dealing with preschool. I ask him because there was an issue, and then he actually says, just say Alex was nice to me today. He'll just tell me. He'll say Alex hit me today. So I'll say, what did you do? And I think he seems now to go and tell one of the instructors.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So let's look at the last one here. How might your expectations change? So he might be doing that when he is not feeling stressed, when he's not feeling any tension, when he's not feeling
mm-hmm.
pushed.
Mm-hmm.
And that expectation of not hitting, not being aggressive, not just using your words is very unrealistic for a 3-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
And he is an impulsive, full of impulses still. He's getting impulse control, but only at when he's not stressed.
Mm-hmm.
So if somebody is doing something he doesn't like, he's still going to be impulsive.
Mm-hmm.
So can you set your expectation to be more developmentally appropriate for him? He's an impulsive boy.
Oh, I see. Like right now my expectation is I don't expect him to be aggressive, but because he's still impulsive, it might come out.
And
so
he is very possibly an aggressive temperament. So here's something that you need to understand is that aggression is not a bad thing,
mm-hmm.
right? Aggression is something that is in our temperaments, and it can go in a violent direction if it's not supported, if it's bottled up, if your expectation is that he must be calm and peaceful
mm-hmm.
and using his words, then he's going to feel pressured. He can't do that.
Can't show his emotion.
He can't meet that expectation. So what you want to do is give him lots of outlets
mm-hmm.
that you come up with yourself where he can be aggressive. Punching pillows, one piece of furniture in the house that he can jump on, maybe a punching bag and punching and boxing gloves, maybe something he can jump up and down on, something that he can rip. You know, you want to give that aggression an outlet that you provide. So you're rechanneling that energy in a positive direction. when you tell him, no, you can't show your aggression,
mm-hmm.
that's when it gets bottled up and grows and grows and grows.
Well, what about, what if you say keep your hands to yourself?
Right. Well,
is that bottling it up?
You can say that. You can say, but put it in a positive. Well, you are. Keep your hands to yourself. Put your hands down and yell. Something like that. You want to allow the energy to express. If you say keep your hands down and what you really mean is calm down completely and don't do anything, then that's going to bottle it up. But if you say put your hands at your sides and yell what you want to say, then you're giving him a way of saying it. And then as he gets a little older, that will all come much more good. Much more appropriate. You know, now he needs to get that out. And he needs to know that he's okay with that energy.
Okay.
That makes sense?
Yep.
Okay.
Thank you, Bonnie.
All right. We are well over time, so I am going to stop now. What I would like you to do for homework is the My Beliefs Complete the Sentence exercise. Page 30 is the example for that, and page 31 is your fill in the sentences. And then on page 32, answer those questions. Again, just more ways of getting to it. All right? And I will see you all next week. Okay, thanks a lot. Bye-bye, everybody.